Now has half an hour to venture to correct misapprehensions, come back on all the horrible things that have been said, and explain herself.
I did have a request over the lunch break from just one person, but it might answer this one. That it might be a good idea if I turn my little thing on. Should I do that?
Well, do so. If
why don't I do it and see what happens and if it blasts you out of. Is that better?
Yes.
Yes.
Right. The first thing that I need to say in reply to really both of these folk, to Charles and to Alan, is that, well, it's to say an absolutely huge thank you. Because the thing that you want most of all when you've written something, you want people to read it. And these two have read it with such meticulous going through almost every phrase. I've got a file that fast of email exchanges with Alan. I've got Charles responded to 27 pages of single spaced comment, you know, and so on. And that's just brilliant. You know, that's really, really brilliant. And then they've also brought some of all that stuff into today's session. So, my heartfelt thanks to you both, you splendid fellows. just lovely that. So now I have to start answering you back. And I'll start with Charles. I think the situation here is that I'm in that Isaiah Berlitz, it's that setup where you've got hedgehogs and foxes, and I can never remember which way round. Who has the one big idea? Is it the hedgehog or the fox?
It's a hedgehog.
The hedgehog. Right, well, I want to deal with one big idea from Charles, the hedgehog idea, and then there are perhaps several small ones from Alan. The one big idea that I want to do with Charles, but we're not surprising at all, is his notion of ROC, his notion that the whole organic process is geared towards continuousness and continuing love. And since he puts us, persons, human, homo sapiens, whatever you want to call us, into that same category, that's what we're about as well. We are, as part of the organic process, we are about doing our bit that process should continue. Now, I think this is just monumentally wrong. Monumentally wrong. And that is because, and it's a strange thing to say in the circumstances, it's strange because he's such a lovely bloke that he actually, I think he gets the biology wrong because he's such a lovely bloke. Because he wants it to be possible to pull love and equality and all these decent things out of an organic process. And therefore, he presents the organic process as it isn't. So I just want to say where I think he presents the organic process wrongly. Across much of the second half of the last century, as many people know here and some better than me, there's been a battle fought out in evolutionary psychology. In evolutionary biology. About the level at which natural selection operates. And this is, I'm going to put this very, very crudely, and it is oversimplified, but it's the best that I can do. That we began with the idea, I say we, I mean biological theorists, began with the idea that it operates at the level of the group. So, what you have, do you remember all those thumper rabbits? All those rabbits that were thumping away in order to warn the group that there was some danger, they were sacrificing themselves, but it was okay because it was for the good of the group. And that was, I say it was the initial starting point. I don't think that's quite accurate. I think there was some idea before that in the 19th century, but never mind. The initial starting point for this century, the last century, for instance. So the group was the unit of selection. That was the first position. In the second position, which I think has turned out to be, it's still wrong, but it's less dramatically wrong than that one, was to say, no, it's not the group, it's the individual. Natural selection operates at the level of the individual. So, and this meant the individual organism. So, individual organisms will, if it's necessary, which happily it isn't, but sometimes it is, will basically fight to the death in order that it's their genes that will survive rather than the next fellow's. And that's the level at which it was thought natural selection took place. I can, if I think straight, associate particular names with particular biologists with this, but just at the moment I can't do that. But the third position, which as I understand it, Charles, is the accepted, recognised, the working hypothesis for biologists now, is that that too is the wrong level. We've moved from group to individual, and now we're down to gene. Not necessarily a single gene, but a combination of genes. And natural selection, so the mainstream arguments, as I understand it goes, operates at the level of the genes. This is now the orthodoxy. Now, I'm not a biologist. I read their stuff, and it seems to make sense to me, since it's the orthodox position, I go along with it. Now, what it seems to me that Charles is doing with his arrow C is he's moving in exactly the opposite direction. The biologists have been going from group to individual to gene, and Charles is going right up to the whole organic process. He's got this conception that somehow natural selection is at work to defend the interests of the whole organic process. What are those interests? That it should continue. Or what is that main interest? That it should continue. Now, I, as I say, I think that's wrong. If you think of it in sort of classical prisoner's dilemma terms, if there were only two species left on the planet, and only a strategy of self-sacrificing cooperation would ensure the value-neutral continuance of the whole organic system, then I think biological theory, as it's now interpreted, would predict that no such cooperation would be available, and that competition, let us say we've got competition for what have become very scarce resources, would ensure instead a fight to the death, and the whole process, the whole organic process, would go down the tubes. Because there actually is no mechanism available to get that sort of cooperation. What you've got is gene competition, right down at that gene level. So, the idea of the interests of the whole organic process being to continue is a notion that I just can't make any sense of. I just think it's got the biology wrong. What's more, every aspect of our behaviour can't be grounded both in increasing the probability that the organic process will continue, or in increasing the probability that our bit of the organic process will continue, as Charles often puts it. He says, the whole organic process will continue, or at least our bit of it will. Now, that's the problem. Those two are in contradiction with one another. That one particular bit of it should continue is almost necessarily in competition with the ideas of the whole thing should continue. Let's try and give an example. Suppose again there are only two species left on the planet. We've got, let's say, slime moulds and daffodils. That's all that's left. Some major catastrophe has produced that situation. Slime moulds and daffodils. This is their situation. If each species modifies its slime mould or daffodil behaviour so that fewer but some slime moulds would maximally flourish and fewer but some daffodils would maximally flourish, then the organic process as a whole could continue. But if each species continues to behave in its slime mold or dendritic fashion, the organic process would come to an end. As I understand current evolutionary biological thinking, their prediction would be, right, the organic process will come to an end. Because there is no mechanism whereby within that process you've got something which is, as it were, working away for continuous. There's no mechanism. The genes are fighting each other. But this, I mean, put it this way, if you like. If it's in my, thinking of me as a biological organism, if it's in my interests that my bit of the organic process should continue, and it's in Charles's interest that his bit of the organic process should continue, then we cannot necessarily get into a position where both of us are doing anything of us in this final death situation we're competing for resources, where both of us are doing anything other, or our genes working through us are doing anything other, than competing for that, whatever it is that's left. There is no mechanism for arguing within biology as it's currently interpreted, to argue that what is going on there is that the organic process operates at the level of the whole process. Now, there's lots of other stuff that I can say, but before it says, I'm going to adjust your microphone. It's falling down here.
Is it not working?
No, it's working all right. It's all right, let's have a say. Where's the head bit? Okay, now there's lots of other stuff that I could say. I could make that what Charles said. But I think it's important, well, I find it important just to make really that one. If I just sort of flip through some of the other things. Oh, I suppose when he said that he thought that what I was doing was analysing philosophical conversation rather than making empirical observations. Well, the empirical observation that I'm making is of philosophical conversation. What do you think I've been doing coming to Ruley House all these times? Sitting in on philosophical conversations. And they provided my raw data for this is what happens when there is a conversation on this or that or the other thing. That's the sense in which the empirical observation is of philosophical conversation, which I try to make it so in the book. Charles dealt a lot with equality. I'm going to leave that. I think the problem, if it comes up in discussion in the plenary, then fine. But I think the problem basically there is that we're talking on totally different timescales, really. Charles seemed to be saying, I don't like the idea of equality. And what I felt like doing is sort of putting my arm around you and saying, there, it's all right, you'll never know what Charles because I'm talking about a long process. And my daughter Kathy was saying to me in the lunch break, and I thought this was really important, she says, it's funny, you know, how people challenge the equality that we haven't yet got, in this case economic equality, while they've got so used to the equalities that we already have got. Nobody anymore challenges equalities between men and women, or equalities of one person, one vote, or equalities of people of different sexual orientations, etc. Because we've lived with them for a while. But think about it, everybody used to challenge them. Everybody. I mean, John Stuart Mill, when he was trying to argue for the equality of women, had one hell of a job to get people to even see there was a problem, let alone that, you know, he was a solution, or he was a possible solution. So I think maybe the way to think about economic equality, if it worries you, is and B, all the other equalities that human beings have ever achieved have been thought impossible or balmy or that in historical terms. But I don't think I'll pick up any of the others of Charles's, because I've already gone beyond my wandering ideas. So if I now turn to Alan, I find it harder to know just exactly how to respond to Alan. I think it's because he's making a whole series of small points rather than one big thing. I mean, it's easier to respond to one big thing. At least that's the story I'm telling myself. So I'm just going to try to respond to perhaps three of the things that he said. First of all, to respond to his accusation of scientism. You'll see from the glossary that scientism is not a word that I would use. I think it's a bogus idea. It's just an excuse to being able to attack science. If you attack science, you're regarded as being a bit of a troglodyte. But if you attack scientism, well, that's okay, so you can do that. But basically, what often people are doing is they're attacking the same thing under two different names. So it wouldn't be a notion that I would use. And particularly, would it not be a notion that I would use, as Alan used it in the leaflet, because he talked about, and I was waiting for him to say it here, and he didn't. He talked about blinkered scientism. Now, I think that's a very strange idea. Scientism is, as I understand it, it's an hypothesis. It is the hypothesis that science is going to be able to explain, can explain lots of things now, will eventually be able to explain everything. That's the hypothesis. Now, a hypothesis can't be either blinkered or non-blinkered. A hypothesis is an idea. The people who put forward hypotheses can be blinkered or otherwise in their putting forward of them. But that means that you could put forward the hypothesis of scientism in a blinkered way. What would that mean? It would mean you hadn't considered any other possibilities, you hadn't really taken seriously all the other possibilities, and you were just putting it forward in a blinkered way. Or you could put forward the hypothesis of scientism in a non-blinkered way, which I hope I'm doing. Which is to consider the possibilities, weigh up the pros and cons of other possibilities. It might be that some of the things and happenings in our world will not be able to be investigated scientifically. Weigh it all up and come to the conclusion, right, I think scientism, if I was to use the word, because I think it's just a rude word really, scientism actually is a respectable hypothesis. So I think it's unfortunate when we're dealing with scientism. Well, I'm not dealing with scientism, but when people use scientism really as a way of, say, it's really just a way of saying, I don't like that thing, you know, I don't like that, or I don't agree with that, or that's not the way in which I see the world. I do think that the best hypothesis going is that all material things and all happenings are amenable to scientific investigation. I think that's the best. I haven't come across one that isn't. It's the best hypothesis going. And if that's going to be labelled scientism, I won't accept the label because I know it's a rude word. But I do accept the proposition that all things are likely to be able to be investigated scientifically. And that's not because I'm blinkered, it's because I've considered the alternatives and thought this one's the better. So that's on scientism. Now, secondly, on where do I go next to Alan? Well, another smallish point. He talks about how children learn language and the Mowgli story and so on as a way of questioning my linguistic structuring idea. I did find, and I make a point in the book. I did find it quite difficult to get hold of what is the dividing line as far as linguistic structuring is concerned. To some extent, it depends upon
It depends upon whether you think we are structured by afferent import or afferent output. So if you think of a small child, it's got input, linguistic input, right from birth. Indeed, some people say from before birth, you know, that it can get linguistic input, recognizing its mother's voice and so on, before birth. But certainly from birth, there's linguistic input. So if the way in which language structures a human nervous system is a function of input, then you could say that a young baby is a person right from birth, or maybe even before birth. If, however, you're going to talk in terms of linguistic output, then you've got to talk in terms of, well, from 1 year. The usual point at which people who study child language development puts this is they put it at around about 18 months, and they say it emerges with two-word sentences. Two-word sentences, because one-word sentences are sometimes difficult to differentiate them from what are called holophrases, you know, things like hold on, which is basically a whole sentence in one little exclamation. But with two-word sentences, you've got the beginnings of some sort of a grammar. So, I agree that there is a problem about what you should call a person. Is somebody before two-word sentences a proto-person? Or is it a fully fledged person because it's input that counts? Now, let me just show you a doodle then. I make no great claims for this doodle, but for the last, it's been 3 or 4 months or maybe more, my whole life has been when people have said to me, will I do X or Y, and I've always thought, after unity. Sometimes I thought, you know, the world must end actually. I suppose it won't. But when I was having a little doodle, thinking about what do I do after unity, I don't know whether the rest of you do this, but I very often doodle when I'm thinking. And so this is my doodle. I said, okay, there's a body, and then I remember that it's got a metabolism, so it's got to be open to its environment. So put a crack in it. There's a body. Let's say a human body. And as part of the body, there is a nervous system inside it. And it was when I started doing it to myself, saying, and that's the powerhouse. In a sense, if what a sentient creature is a creature that's got directed movement. Change, and we should insist on always saying the only thing we can do is move things. That's it. And you've got to interpret all of human behaviour, all animal behaviour, in terms of moving things. Okay, that's the powerhouse doing the way I was. And I was thinking, well, is it linguistic input or output that matters for where you say, okay, here we've got a person. So I started to draw little bits of linguistic input. You know, there's its mother's voice, there's its father's voice, there's the neighbour shouting in from the side. And this is all obviously being processed in, when I say obviously, it's being processed in some way by this, which is the powerhouse of the body nervous system. But then, at a point which, let's say, is about 1 year of age. Well, an infant means without speech, so an infant is up to 1 year. After 1 year, you've got speech. Then there becomes some output in that the person who produces it has its own voice. It starts saying things like hold on and all the rest of it. And I looked at that and I thought, what does that remind me of? It's a neuron, I thought. I doodled a neuron. And then I thought, well, what's the difference? Between a neuron and this little doodling thinking I'm doing. And I thought, well, when this child produces its first morphemes, not phonemes, phonemes, Charles, I would say, are at the level of the biosphere. Those are just noises which the 6 speech organs of all members of the species can produce because they've got all the sorts of things you talked about, the drop flora and all the rest of it. They're noises. About 44 or something of them in the English language. But when you get to morphemes, you've got not just noises, but you've got things that stand for things. You've got meaning
or don't ask for the meaning, ask for the use. Use this morphine in this circumstance, this morphine in that. So, once you've got a child producing morphemes or combinations of morphemes into words, you've got a funny thing happens, which I'm sure, I don't know, if we've got any biologists here, I'd love to ask, do any neurons do this? I can't connect it. Where the axon connects back on and becomes, becomes input again. One's own voice coming out of one's mouth becomes input back in, usually through one's ears, if one's a fully operating thing, body. And as far as I know, no neurons connected up in the nervous system do anything like that. No axons, you know, come back as an input again. Now I suspect, and one of the things I'm going to try and do after dinner sense, which is starting tomorrow, whenever there is to think about that idea, because there is something which is Libet-like, if you know the Libet experiment. There is something which is Libet-like, I think, here, in my own shape's head. Because you've got some number of milliseconds, I don't even know how many milliseconds it is, for this output to become again input. You've got some delay situation in the system.
It's 400 milliseconds.
Is it 400? Okay, you've got some delay system. You've got some delay in the system.
You're defining in classic control theory feedback.
Yes, I know. Well, I didn't know when I was doing, but when I was today, as friends, I said, yeah, that's what you do. There's some delay in the system, which perhaps means, and this is what I'm going to be which perhaps means that what I'm talking about with linguistic structuring is, because I do say in the book very specifically, I think nobody knows how language structures brains. I think an awful lot of people say it does somehow. People put a whole host of different theories forward. I don't think there's any one which is any more favoured than the rest. But maybe one can get over the is it afferent or is it efferent, the one for the choice take both, by saying, well, it's input which becomes, after some months delay, output, which output then also itself becomes input. Have I only got one here? Okay, so that was on language, and I haven't talked about any of the others at Alan's point. And I did have loads of them down. Can I just, in 1 minute, I'll just say one thing. Then, try and say one thing in 1 minute. One of your phrases, Alan, was we make statements about our bodily behaviour. And I think one of the things that's happening here is that the proposal that I'm making is much more radical than is being, certainly than is being accepted, but that's even being, that is being acknowledged in the criticism so far. Because it is a necessary part of the position that I'm putting forward, and I pick out that one, but there were several other phrases. Which means that we make statements about our bodily behaviour is an incoherent remark. We do not make statements about our bodily behaviour. We are, is what I'm saying, we are in part statements about our bodily behaviour, statements about whether there are blue chairs in this room, statements about everything. That's what we are, statements being linguistic whatnot. So it's not a correct representation of my position. My position might be balmy, but it's not a correct representation of it to say things like we make statements about our bodily behaviour, or what makes experience belong to one sequence rather than another. I mean, I think the answer to what makes experience belong to one sequence than another is pretty straightforward, really. It's because it's the experience which is passing through one nervous system rather than another. If the happening called thinking is going on through this nervous system that's in here, and another happening called thinking is going on through another nervous system, which is yours and over there, then what makes those experiences part of what is in one case, in each case a person, is the fact precisely that it's going on in one nervous system, each two different nervous systems. And the thing we know about nervous systems is that they can't be in two states at the same time. If you define experience in this sort of a way, you're defining it in terms of states of a nervous system. So all those stories about, you know, there's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and there's maybe two personalities sitting inside the body, they might all make good short stories, or they might all be, you know, nice flights of fancy. But in terms of trying to understand what it is that a person is, it's just not true. And Anne Friedman, who's a psychologist who worked here in this university some time ago, did some wonderful experiments in which what she was doing was playing two different linguistic inputs into two ears of a person at the same time, and then she was separating the inputs by just a little bit in order to see could you actually deal with two inputs at the same time. And she found that as long as there was a hell of a lot of redundancy in the messages, you could do it. But as soon as there was any sort of significant redundancy in the messages, you couldn't do it. What you had to do is you had to flip back and forward. Sorry, I got that wrong. We all the time have to flip back and forward between the two messages. We can't attend to both. If there's enough redundancy in the messages, and we're flipping fast enough, we can get hold of both. But put more redundancy in other words, make one statement about the state of this room at the moment and another statement about Saddam Hussein, and there's no way in which we can do it. And that makes a very powerful point about a nervous system being a singular, well, Charles makes this point seem very well, a singular biologically evolved system for dealing with the world in which it's operating. Yes, I've got to shut up now. And it wouldn't actually work if it was trying to deal with if its conception of the world was not singular. So I think that's more or less definitional that what a nervous system is doing is operate, which is why I can't make any sense really of the binding problem as it's called with consciousness.
Thank you, Anne. Very much. That was pretty good. Can we